Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. If I had to give a title to Camille's talk this morning, I might give it something like speaking from Tawheed. Tawheed being the oneness of everything. But taking the realization of Tawheed to a very broad showing in a very broad scope. Ancestry, DNA, the unity of humanity is one aspect of it, a very important aspect. But the Tawheed too extends throughout the universes. And it also includes a relationship between what we might call the intelligence, the loving, beneficent intelligence of the universe, which is in communication with all of these individual witnesses and which has created the programming language of the universe, which is DNA, in order to give each of us a particular signature within this realm of cosmic life. Yes, it's all one, and at the same time, each of us has a unique signature. So even in our essential nature as witnesses, that witnessing is happening from the perspective of that individualized signature, which is partly shaped by your DNA, the DNA itself being much more than just a physical determinant. It's not an entirely materialistic mechanism, but it is a mechanism that also connects to the realm of mind and shapes the quality of mind we have. I want to review some things. I want to bring us down to earth a little bit. I know we've been in heaven, and so forgive me, because I know you are people of earth. I know you all too well. You are meant to be, you are meant to become the living Quran. You are meant to embody this revelation, not to believe it, but to embody it, so that you yourself become that the reality that the Quran reveals with all of its beauty and mercy, which was shared with us this morning. And a vision of Tawheed, a vision of oneness, that can really begin to encompass the real nature of Tawhid, not as some kind of theological doctrine or abstraction, but as a perspective that allows us to see what is the real and to see the relationships within the real, which are the relationships of our humanity and all of humanity and ultimately all of life cooperating, as we know. There are wheat has more detail in its DNA than the human being. Did you know that? Strange. If you analyze the genetic structure of wheat, there's more there. There's more information there than there is in your DNA. I don't know what that means, but just an aside. We don't even eat wheat most of the time, unless it's a cupcake. That's my Naf speaking. But I think there are some important realizations and understandings that we can share and review from this weekend, and some things that I partially explained or shared and want to give a little more definition to. You know, there is the individual human witness who is conscious to some extent, to whatever extent we are, and who has thoughts and emotions and reactions as any subjective individuality will. That's one aspect of us. Now there's another interesting aspect that I think deserves some reflection, and that is that we're in relationship to something that we might call the beneficent life force, which is almost, and maybe it is, a definition of the divine. But there's some nuances here to be looked at. You know, there was this very popular book, what was it called? Oh, the Law of Attraction. You know, this sort of this New Age idea that you attract your life, and therefore you only have to think of what you want, and you will attract it. Is that true? If that's true, then where does God, where does the divine fit into this picture? What's the nature of the divine, and is it just the law of attraction? And therefore, is it up to you to attract what you think is good? And well, or is this a half-truth? Is there this life force, this mechanism within reality that works in this way? And what about God's will? And what about God's guidance and grace? And how do we relate all of these things? Well, let's say that there is something like an intermediate realm of energies that can be awakened and organized and solicited, invited, employed by human consciousness. Let's say there is such a thing. So let's say that you could fulfill your desires through this. What would that lead to? There's a story they tell about a poor couple who are living in a little hut, and the guy goes out one day and he discovers some kind of genie or something like that, and the genie says, well, I'm going to grant you, you know, 7 wishes. And he comes back and he tells his wife, and he's very excited, and he tells her, and she says, well, tell her we want to get out of this hovel and we want a nice little cottage. So he goes back and tells the genie, and boom, suddenly there's the cottage. So they're happy for about a day. And then he said, well, really, what I would like is, you know, something a little bit bigger. We need a few bedrooms. We need a guest room. And so husband dutifully goes back, asks the genie, and boom, They have, you know, a better place. And then she's still not happy. They're not happy. She's especially not happy. She wants a manor house. No. And boom. Now they've got the manor house. And, well, that's, you know, it's pretty good for a little while, but in a few days, if we can have all this, why can't we have a palace? And boom, they've got a palace. And then she's thinking, but I would like to be a queen and my husband a king. So boom, now they're queen and king. And then next she thinks, really, I would like to be able to control the sun and the moon. And boom, they're back in their hovel. The law of attraction. And if we could fulfill our desires that reliably through the law of attraction, yes, we can. You can. You can do that to some extent, depending on how skillful you're going to be in doing it. But what you wind up is a handful of ashes. That's the truth of it. This is what the spiritual traditions teach us. Yes, you can fulfill your desires and you will find out what they are really worth, what your desires are worth. And of course, it may take lifetimes to realize the truth of this through hard experience. But there's something going on here. We spoke about the I-ness without I, the witness. And recently I've been working for a number of months on an essay, which will soon be on our website, called The Foundations of Heartfulness. And describing so far six principles to guide us into heartfulness, which is like mindfulness and more. Mindfulness is mostly awareness. Heartfulness is something we believe more complete and more characteristic of the Sufi tradition. You know, we emphasize a certain quality of presence and mindfulness in our daily activities. It's relevant on a certain level. But there's a number of qualities that contribute to heartfulness. And they have been the theme, the monthly themes of the last 6 months. And we finally arrived at number six in October, which is be content, be pleased with what is, and then act from your heart. Be pleased, be in rida, but then act from your heart. But this is the sixth of them. And others included patience, which is a kind of relationship to time. Another was an understanding of la ilaha illallah, understood as putting aside all preconceptions and with la ilaha, all idols, all fantasies, and coming to illallah and acquainting to that illallah a little bit like what the Buddhists call beginner's mind. It's a different, slightly different take on la ilaha illallah. In other words, approaching reality in a fresh way with beginner's mind. Another was to strive in God. To strive, jihad. But the jihad not of making an effort as we often make efforts, an effort that grows out of the self and the desires of the self, but including the desires to make me a better person, which is just, it's egoistic, but it's more subtly egoistic. It's the kind of deep conditioning Mahmud was talking about that we need to discover. But a striving that is in God. You could say, as even Abhadaranda expresses it, to strive with the divine companion at your side. And there's beautiful confirmation of this in an ayat in the Quran that says, and it's, I never translated this way, but the Arabic does say, and strive, and strive in Allah. Usually it's translated strive for or toward Allah, but it says strive. Wajahidu haqqa fi Allah. As God deserves, in other words, and strive as is rightful in God. And so this is a different quality of striving. Now, returning to this primary sense of being that is your very nature, your intrinsic nature, your true witness, which has been in all of us some of the time or much of the time, is obscured by all of the agendas of the nafs, which include, and let me just reiterate what some of these are. The first, the big illusion, the big lie, is that we should be here without any disturbance. We should just be sailing through life without any obstacles, without any friction, without any disturbance. And if that's not happening, something's wrong. Maybe even God doesn't love us. Which is very different from the attitude of a spiritual warrior, which is, I'm here in trust and faith. I embrace every moment. I embrace every difficulty and challenge, as well as every joy, with the same attitude, with thankfulness, with appreciation, with knowing that this is the course. I'm not looking for trouble. I'm not expecting to suffer. That's not it. It's not. I'm not hoping to suffer in order to overcome these challenges. I simply approach it all, keeping up my spirits and accepting it with gratitude and appreciation, rather than living under the illusion that it should be otherwise, that I shouldn't have to face difficulties, and or that when I finally figure things out and I get the right job, the right home, the right partner, whatever it is, the right, getting all the right things, I will have no more problems. This is not the reality we live in. We also have these subsets of egoistic behaviors and attitudes, which, again, Mahmud rightly pointed out, they're immature, they're childish. One is demanding attention of others, especially unconsciously. Or needing approval of others to be happy, and often compromising our own integrity in order to win the approval of others. Another is seeing the purpose of life as maximizing pleasure, especially sensory pleasure, but it could also be egoistic pleasure of status, prestige. And another, a fourth one, is close to that. These are all very close to each other. Fourth one is the need to be in control, especially to control others and to get others to do what we want them to do, and how we blackmail each other and shame each other and or use anger to control people or to try to control people, which and using imposing guilt on others. All these games that are part of the structure of the false self. These are all strategies of the false self. Let's add to those the world we live in today, a world which can include these large games, one of them is the game of religiosity, which is, if I behave in a certain way, if I do the right rituals and have the right beliefs, I will win points with God, and if I don't do them, I will be punished. And this is basically, I summarize all of this as the religion of fear. Usually this is what it comes down to. The religion of fear is quite common in the world, though it's a very ecumenical religion. It welcomes into itself Muslims, Christians, Jews, Buddhists, Hindus, can all be part of the religion of fear, especially too often the institutionalized versions seem to find this a very convenient strategy for control and organization. Then we have the factor of consumerism, corporate consumption, consumerism and consumption as a way to happiness, and a whole vast mind control system. Forgive me for talking about these very worldly things, but I know these affect every one of us. The way this system works is that through advertising, through the whole system of worldly communication, supporting consumerism and consumption, you are told you're not pretty enough, you're not beautiful enough, you're not perfect enough, you need this product to improve yourself, you need cosmetics, you need the latest fashion, you need your hair different, you need to be more hot. Hot. I mean, especially our younger generation is getting this, you know, propagandized, and especially young women. It's really something. That's what's going on. And mix that in with celebrity culture, you know, where the true idols of our time are the celebrities. Nobody's falling for little wooden objects and worshiping them anymore, or little stone figurines. But, you know, we have our idols, our idolatries are now so, you know, creatively presented with special effects, photoshopped, etc., etc. So all of this is contributing to your sense that you're not good enough because of how you look, your shape, your features, whatever. And then add to that, well, gee, that's an ugly car you drive. You need a new car. You know, or whatever. It's time to remodel the bathroom. Or, you know, and everybody's driving, being driven to kind of meet these demands. And what is the solution? Well, it's as all the traditions have told us and remind us, come back to that state of being, which is the pure witness, which knows contentment, appreciation, gratitude. Because if we're not in that state, what's happening is these other selves, they are taking over and they're speaking in your name. And who are they speaking to? The life force. They're sending messages to the life force all the time, consciously or unconsciously. And the life force, as a mechanism to this goes quite deep, but as a mechanism that ultimately is merciful because it's teaching us what's real and what's not real. Like that couple who went through all their real estate improvements and finally wound up with a handful of ashes in their own hovel. So ultimately the life force taught them, no, this is not the way, this is not going to satisfy you. This is not where true happiness lies. But the mechanism is there. You send those random egoistic messages to the life force. The life force says, okay, you know, you want this, you can have this. Try it out. See what that's like. Sometimes it's not happening as gracefully and as beautifully as that, because we also send very chaotic messages, especially when the messages are negative about ourselves, you know, judgmental, blaming others. We create chaos in the world. We create a chaos of energies and conflicts in the whole world. And yes, there's a relationship between energies and mind, and our discordant desires and all of the false realities that create all of these false selves, and all of these false selves within these false realities, by the way, created by consumerism, by the religion of fear, by power structures that wish to control us through fear and motivate us and send us to war and profit, and people profiting from the wars, endless wars. America's been at war constantly since World War II. We've never stopped being at war. How suggestible people are to just go marching off to war all the time and to glorify it. And God's mercy is even operating in that, because despite all of this, people find love in war. They find brotherhood. They find, in a way, a kind of truth. And yet they also suffer terribly, and they're wounded, and they're damaged physically, psychologically, spiritually. You see the picture? Forgive me. We're coming down from the beautiful heavenly Tawheed down to this world which is at war. Even elements are at war in this world. But hopefully we're coming back to it with a new knowledge that we can be God's impartial witness as the consciousness of the divine in this world. And the divine is here to support us in the most generous and beautiful ways imaginable. But the divine only asks us to report back truly as an objective witness, not to be allowing all these other false selves to do the talking for us and to be sending their nonsense to the life force, but to come back and say, Ya Allah, oh my God, I trust you and only you. I thank you for what is right now. I thank you for these blessings. I rely upon you. I need you. What do I need you for? Well, Allah, I need more patience. Oh, Allah, I need more humility. Oh, my God, I know how easily distracted I am by these false realities. They're speaking to me from every side. How will I make the journey from the false to the real? Show me the real. And these messages are there. They're in the revelations. Show me the real as the real, and give me the benefit of following it. Show me the false as the false, and give me the benefit and the blessing of avoiding it. You know? So it's all there in the spiritual teachings. It's very clear and it's very pure in our own tradition, if we don't mix in the false religion of fear into the Din al-Haq, the religion of truth, which is the religion of love. We here are all aspiring to the religion of love. which is also the religion of truth, the Din al-Haq, the simple religion of Abraham, which comes from that being, that Abrahamic-like being who could say, no, I worship only you. I don't wish these other things. I know that if this witness, this being that I am, can just meet all the conditions of life with trust, with gratitude, with conscious, explicit appreciation, that I rely upon is going to send his knowledge, his inspiration, guidance, generous beauty, miraculous meanings, true happiness, true beauty, the perception of true beauty, inside and outside. We will show you our signs on the farthest horizons and in ourselves. The promise from that source is so great, so profound. And in a way, all it requires of us is that we be here and not be caught up in these other games. Or if we are, and we will be caught up in the other games, of course we will, but can we notice? And then say, as we say in our tradition, La ilaha, meaning let go of the idols. And almost anything that we make too important is an idol. That doesn't mean we should be so laid back and mellow that nothing matters. No, but it means that we put other things in the place of God. If you make anything too important, it can become an idol and awaken a kind of a wrong kind of stress, and it then begins to occupy the place of God. Even if I make virtue, my virtue, too important, I've got to be really virtuous, I'm making myself an idol. And if I make my religion or my spiritual path all important, it can become an obstacle to simply witnessing what is. Mahmood, did you want to say something? Question. Could we have a microphone handy?
As you're talking about these things that you know the what's in the world today, it seems to me that this is also part of the design. That's part of the tawheed. But I'd like to ask: can we explore that more to help us understand more how all of these things that are competing for our attention and that we struggle with, you know, they're there to serve a purpose.
Okay, good.
I sense that, right? That it has to be serving a purpose to bring us closer to unity somehow, but I don't know how. You know, it's, my relationship with it is negative. And I'd like to know how it can be more positive, but to use these things in an integrating way instead of, you know, having them, even.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, I think this was the theme of Jim's talk yesterday, how the great tests of life are actually, you know, a divine mercy. And always in the encounter, you know, there is an opportunity to see how we are distracted, seduced, waylaid, and then how we wake up from that and return to what is feels positive, what feels true in our own being. The principle that we say very often, remind ourselves of, is that if there are qualities of mercy on the one hand and stringency on the other, that the attributes of mercy far outweigh the attributes of stringency, and the stringency in the end is also in the service of the mercy. So pain can be a channel to a direct channel to blessing and realization. We talk about this often. I think it's a very basic part of the teaching, that everything is from the mercy of God. Nothing is purely evil, and the divine teaches by contrast, and that's how we're learning. So we accept that we're in this world, and if anybody would like to offer examples of this and insights, we're still learning. I'm still learning about this. But I think it was implied in the very beginning when I said, we live under the illusion. The illusion is that we should glide through this world undisturbed, without difficulty. And when we meet disturbance, we think something's wrong. But no, nothing's wrong. This is just the course we're taking. This is how our souls are being awakened and strengthened and developed. But if anybody would like to offer anything about your understanding of this, please.
I have the same question a lot of the time, but it just reminded me of working in home health as an occupational therapist. We see clients come in with, say, a stroke, and the physical therapist does one thing, and the speech therapist does something else, and the OT does something else, and the nurse does something else. And the rehab staff particularly really all want their program to make this transformation. But I realized that this person who had suffered the stroke had all of this interaction from the hospital all the way through the rehab center to home health, and then we were kind of the last part of it. And I began to realize it's a lot more like farming than anything else. So each of us began to understand that we had a part to play. Some of us were planting seeds, some of us were watering the seeds, some of us were cultivating, and not everybody got to harvest. And I stopped straining in that situation because I'm trying to get this person to do something. And I began to kind of relax and understand that there were so many people involved in just that one journey, that each of us showing up with such purity of intention and giving the gifts that we can give at the time of the sequence of the crop, basically. And some people would never see the results of the crop often. And it was amazing to be able to be the one that got to harvest something. So mm-hmm. I'm sort of mixing metaphors, but that's where I began to have appreciation for that. And it is a good reminder for me, as I feel kind of perplexed by the complexity of what we face every day. And I'm not in that immediate kind of situation now where it's that apparent to me, but just knowing that being clear and doing what's in front of me is part of the larger ecosystem that I can't comprehend. So that's
helpful. Thank you. Netta would like to speak.
So for me, I'm beginning to understand more the physical connection of my body to my emotions. And what helps me be more objective is I try to think of every experience that comes at me as like a crossing point, like I'm crossing a street, and usually what I do is I just go and I don't look, and I end up going in circles because I'm constantly just not thinking about my reaction, I'm just reacting. And so now I really try to understand, like, I'm a sensory machine. I have input that's coming in and I'm outputting. And a lot of times when I feel like an overload of stimuli, I guess, I forget that it's actually like a communication method. And as a woman, I guess I'm really attached to my emotions, and I can really like just go back to a situation and time is irrelevant at this point and like feel the emotion as if it happened that day or that moment. And so I really think that paying attention to your emotions is a really good indicator of how to stop and breathe and then decide, look both ways. There's cars coming from the right and there's cars coming from the left. And depending on your reaction, you can either get hit and not know what happened, or like kind of pay attention to the dangers that the ego is bringing to you. And so that really just helps me be more objective, is to kind of step away, like come over here on top. That's the only way I can describe it, is like bring your consciousness to the top and then kind of look around and see what's actually happening, not what hurt. Like feel the pain, but don't really jump and react to it so suddenly. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense.
But that's what that's what I'm seeing is really helping me kind of flow and hear what God is actually trying to teach me, not just think like, woe is me, like this life is so full of despair, and which it is, but I think that if you kind of transform it, you can help transmute that into joy for other people, because we're all kind of suffering. So
yes, thank you, Netta. Yes.
Yes, I was just thinking about an artist. I was speaking to a brother here, Henri Matisse, and his life. I went to a class in Montclair, and they was basically talking about this artist and his life. He grew up in northern France, where it was a very dark place, but a lot of his artwork, if you actually see, is very colorful. But the way he started out as an artist, he was first an accountant, because basically he's part of the family business. He came through an illness, I believe, and then he just started to paint, and he just got really into it. But then something happened. He contracted another illness where he couldn't use his hands correctly. And then his artwork actually became more beautiful after that. And then he was struck down with another illness where he couldn't hardly move. He started doing these paper mache's, and it got even more beautiful as the time went on. So every time he had a complicated life, but every time he came through like an illness or something almost debilitating, it's like he was creating something even more beautiful from it. His artwork actually got more recognition actually from that. And towards the end of the class, they were talking about him doing something for a church in France, and I believe in Nice, south of France. And I love art. Like, I used to work at a print shop. I actually draw, and it's not my profession, but it's something that I love doing. And for the first time ever, his last work at a church actually made me cry, because it was that beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
towards the end of his life. So it kind of reminds me of when I used to read Nietzsche and how suffering sometimes brings great beauty. So that's basically it. Mm.
Thank you. That's a memorable story, yes. Something in Matisse's soul was not defeated and adapted to every new circumstance and allowed it to be an opportunity for beauty. And Hadim.
I think Mahmoud's question is, it's a big question because one can turn the news on and all the things that you were saying about what we're conditioned to, and I think we're conditioned to consume. And also there's a conditioning to entitlement that we have about consuming. And when I look out into the world and I see, the suffering and the greed, and there are some times when I weep for that, and knowing that I can't fix it. But I have this trust that there's something transpiring behind that which appears that I may not be able to comprehend, but I can trust in it. So I have this very, may seem childlike, but I imagine and I experience that we are all in this ocean of love. And we're all in these little leaf boats. And we all have oars. And when I think of that ocean, I think of people that there's a part of me that could really churn up some intense dislike for. And so when I'm struggling with something like that, I put the corporation, the person in the leaf boat, and I know that we're all there together. There isn't anything that is excluded from that. And that sometimes somebody in that leaf boat may only have one oar and they're going around and around and around and around. And sometimes they don't have an oar. But there's this deep sense of trust in that ocean of love. And that's what I attune to. And I can, and even if I, I weep for something, I may get upset at something, but I always go back to that place because I don't have, it has not been my, the Beloved has not given me the capacity to understand what's going on in all of this. And I know that I also trust that there's beauty behind it because that is, I think that's part of the mercy. So we're in that ocean. Yes. And I think, and I return to that more and more because it offers me, it just provides me with to trust and love and to live from that place, even in things that are really, really ugly. Mm-hmm. Looking with an eye of love to see some beauty in that.
Yes. Yes. Thank you, Hadim. I'd like to add a little clarification in case it might have been misunderstood. In delineating these egoistic games and these traps that the false self falls into and all the versions of the false self, in describing this, I'm describing it for myself. I'm describing it as primarily something I and any individual could be more aware of for ourselves. Not to look out and say, oh, look what that person is doing, falling into that false self. That's not at all the reason. This should never be interpreted as a way to blame others or to be looking out there. And likewise with these big, the so-called games of the religion of fear and consumption and all these things. Again, this is not an excuse for blaming anything out there. It is, but it is a tool for self-examination. I really want to emphasize that, because blame is just another one of those games, and it has no part in this spiritual path.
When I was growing up, my mother used to say to me, when I would be blaming one of my sisters, she'd say, "Tend to your own knitting."
Good.
You know, yes. So.
Nice metaphor. Rahima?
When I... in thinking about what Mahmood said, what came to mind is, in my experience, when I become aware of something in myself that it feels needs to change, those negative feelings and negative voices start going, which, as I understand it, really aren't helpful in my experience. And so how that, those negative voices and the nafs initiate that and sabotage the process of transforming. And so discerning the difference between that awareness and knowing and wanting to transform, and yet turning off those voices. And I think that was part of maybe the negative things you were asking about. Because what you give attention to grows. And so if I'm giving attention to all that negative, so how to dance with that? Not giving it negative energy, but yet being aware and giving impetus to that transformation. And another little comment about what Hadim said. I remember very vividly hearing Elizabeth talk about how our prayer and our zikr affect the energy of the world, and how it's not only important for our transformation, but the transformation of the energies in the world as well.
Yes, yes. Giving too much energy to the negative voices may amplify them, but always to just notice this is what's going on is where we begin. We're not shutting anything out. George had his hand up. In the last row.
Well, Kabir, one of the ways in which I allow my false selves to misbehave and speak for me is through control. I'm sort of like Alexander Haig standing up in the White House saying, "I'm in charge here." I really do think that I ought to be. And that makes me irritable and impatient because the people and the world around me don't cooperate. And what I've been finding a mercy, a strange and kind of paradoxical mercy from my Lord in the process of aging. Both from aging and from stroke, I find I don't have the energy to get impatient anymore. I also don't have the energy to try to impose my will on the world as much as I used to. So it's a mercy, and it's slowly but surely teaching me the lessons I need to learn, including taking that second or that 5 seconds to return to the eye that doesn't have eyeness and just watch the crazy guy over there misbehave. Mm-hmm. So I thank my Lord for this mercy of killing me off.
Thank you. Thank you. Well said. Well, we have just a few minutes left before it is time for lunch. There's something very beautiful in the state that we're all offered. That was my reason for presenting this, the picture I've tried to present this weekend, that simply the fact that we can be aware beings and that we have a great need of this relationship with something so infinite and merciful that is our companion in all circumstances of life. And that we've had ample evidence from many people that experiences that seem negative or seem to be experiences of loss or deprivation actually contain hidden mercies. This is what where real faith grows from. And because we're paying attention in a new way, and because we're cultivating something that some in some traditions have, they have called this the creation of a soul, of a soul that can attend to all of the experiences of life and see these experiences as blessings and take the blessings from it and avoid the harm of it. Even Prophet Muhammad said exactly this. When he would enter a new town, he would say, even before entering, he would say, may I receive the good of this place and may I be protected from the harm of it. The harm of it may be what our own egos do with these experiences. The blessings of it may be what our souls receive when we're more conscious, which means not just mentally conscious, but in a conscious state of gratitude and faith and trust and hope. And that, in the end, this is all the self that is so near to us. As Mevlana says in a beautiful poem, you know, why do I call you as if you were so far away? You are my own face. You are my own self, but with complicated thoughts, I separate myself from you. All of the great masters, the great Sufis, have found that in the human heart resides this divine presence, which has an infinite amount of blessing and mercy and intelligence, and it's always there. And my heart is drifting back to Suleiman Dede and others, great, great souls that we've met. We caught the fragrance of Hasan Shushud, a very noble being, austere but noble, and so much living in the truth. That we've had these beings in our lives and to be examples that, yes, this is possible for a human being. And we give thanks for all of it. So this religion of love, this way of love, which is really continually a project of self-knowledge, of knowing the falsity in ourselves and finding that part of ourselves which lives closer to the truth and which is continually moving in the direction of nearness what we call nearness to God. Maybe I hope that in this weekend, the nature of that nearness has become a little bit clearer for us. And that is the definition of sanctity in this tradition, the one who is near to God. Well, God is already near to you, nearer than your very self. So it's just for us to recognize that. And so much comes out of that, so much beauty. So thank you. It's been beautiful to have this time with all of you and all of your contributions and your attention and your friendship, your presence, your faithfulness. You know, there are people here who have been with us for many years, and then it's a delight to have some people here that we're meeting for the first time and who find some value here. And I'm also was noticing that we have three younger people here in the group this time who are the, I can't call you children anymore, but the offspring of dervishes, and that's really beautiful, and we are really touched by your sincerity, your presence with us, because we're, you know, we hope really that you will carry this on to future generations. And so there really is so much to be grateful for, and we wish we had had a chance to speak personally with every one of you, and yet there's not always a need for that. We are already in each other, and we are in each other's hearts and sharing this presence, and often there's much more love between us than we can possibly express. So, with that, Assalamu alaikum.